In the book, when we talk about the rhetoric of power, we talk about ways of seeking to persuade people through embarrassment or intimidation, things that I'm not so proud of now that are still sitting on the internet, really seeing that that wasn't so persuasive in the end. You know, mocking unbelievers or engaging with fellow believers in certain ways that belittled them just wasn't effective. So part of it was just the practical and seeing what worked. People really sort of flower with just a little bit of respect.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn. Joining me in studio is Doug Jones, who until very recently was teaching overseas for several years in the United Arab Emirates and currently teaches history and literature at the Cambridge School in San Diego. He's the author of a number of books, including Why and What, A Brief Introduction to Christianity, and Dismissing Jesus, How We Evade the Way of the Cross. And for the purposes of this conversation, we'll be talking to him about his forthcoming book titled The Rhetoric of Love. Doug, it's great to have you with us.
Oh, thanks so much. Great to be here.
People like me remember you from way back, Credenda Agenda, and all of those fantastic articles that drew many of us into classical Christian education, and we're really glad to have you in the studio.
It's a delight. We had great fun with that publication. We kept our eyes on White Horse Inn through those years and watching what you all were doing, and it's been a fascinating trip.
Well, thanks. What drove you to write this book? Obviously, it's been percolating for a while, as books do.
Yes, part of the motivation just came from years in Christian circles and attempting to persuade using some of the sort of the rhetoric of domination, as the book calls it, trying to use embarrassment and all sorts of tactics, things that I'm not so proud of now that are still sitting on the internet, really seeing that that wasn't so persuasive in the end, that, mocking unbelievers or engaging with fellow believers in certain ways that belittled them just wasn't effective. So part of it was just the practical, that getting to understand people and know people. And part of this came from not only sort of the failure of what I saw in my own rhetoric, but living in another country and trying to connect with people of very different faiths and seeing what worked. People really sort of flower with just a little bit of respect. So those two experiences really played into this book.
So you want to win people and not just arguments.
Definitely.
And especially winning people to the truth, that which is true, good, and beautiful we talk about all the time. But to do it truthfully, beautifully, and with goodness and charity.
Right. And that involves really being interested in people and curious about them and knowing that there's something interesting in them that you can try to bring out and appreciate. And that's where you see some good effects.
You point out that this is not your traditional, you're not going to get this from just reading the great orators of Greek and Roman lore.
Yeah, you'll find people go in different directions on this. But if you think of the major purposes for ancient rhetoric were largely political and legal. And so in many of those situations, the key was, as part of the Greco-Roman mind, to dominate and to subjugate. And
it's good that we've gotten beyond that in our discourse in America.
I wish. It's interesting when you see Christ appear on the scene and you see themes in the Old Testament that push against that. And that's what I wanted to try to bring out.
Everywhere we turn in our media saturated culture, 24-hour news cycles and so forth, we see the opposite of this, don't we? Basically, people are put on there precisely because they represent the extreme ends of our political culture. And so very often it's just ridiculous banter, belittling each other, talking over each other. It's kind of candy. It's not a meal. It's candy. You walk away and say, well, it was kind of fun to watch them go after each other. How dangerous is that?
Yeah, it makes it normal. That's the danger of it. And it's sort of an exhausting normal. And so we get sort of comfortable in living in these extremes. And you see this in Christian circles dealing with different traditions. You know, we don't really talk to unbelievers so much. We
talk sort about of them.
Put memes on social media. Yeah. And we live in our own little circles. But this is what you see many times when, you know, Christians are put in non-Christian situations, they can start to, they have to slow down a little bit when we're not talking to ourselves.
You had to have seen that overseas. That you say that had a big impact on your thinking.
It did. It forces you to go back to sort of very simple questions. I mean, I had Muslim students ask me at times, do Christians pray? Something as simple as that, because they don't see Christians in public the way we see pictures of Muslims praying. And that, you know, slowed me down. You had to really back up and start talking about simple things, not high intellectual arguments, but, you know, do Christians pray?
But you were listening to them rather than reading a book about them.
Yes, yes. And of course, before I went, I tried to read all the books. And then when I got there, saw that, you know, Islam is as complicated as Christianity. And so you've got extremists, you've got really kind, you've got all sorts of things. And I had to go person by person almost. And that was a good lesson.
Person by person. What an interesting. You know, a lot of times today, Doug, you can tell when you're visiting a church, you can tell whether that pastor watches Fox News or MSNBC. Can't you?
Yes, yes.
They're kind of parroting the sectarianism in our political culture. Why is this dangerous, our parroting secular culture in this rhetoric of power? Talk about the rhetoric of power.
Yeah. So in the book, when we talk about the rhetoric of power, we talk about ways of seeking to persuade people through embarrassment or intimidation or destruction. So there are all sorts of levels to doing that. And that's part of our culture. It was part of Greco-Roman culture as well. And it is that parroting, the way you describe it. You know, even in churches that try to have a distinctly Christian view of politics or something like that, we seem to always fall back to sort of the major media one way or another. And this is what made me try to look at the rhetoric of Jesus, the rhetoric of the New Testament, which really was countercultural. And we're not countercultural enough. We think we are, either quoting MSNBC or Fox News, but it is just this parroting. Jesus many times was doing something completely unnerving and unexpected and surprising. I think we've gotten away from the need to be creative. The book talks a lot about creativity as well. And if you're trying to do something with a different angle, then you can't just rely on major media to do that.
A lot of our listeners will be familiar with those three stages Dorothy Sayers talked about: grammar, logic, and rhetoric. And you know, the logic being more about the content and the rhetoric being more about how you present it. You're saying that it's not just the content of Jesus' ministry that was revolutionary and countercultural, but the way he did it. Can you give us some examples?
Yes. Simple things. Using weakness, going into Jerusalem on a donkey, going in contrast to the way Herod would have entered Jerusalem with the pomp and circumstance and army and so forth. But Jesus going in and subverting the sort of popular vision of power.
I am a king, but not that kind.
Yes. Yeah. Mm. And that's surprising. And of course, he disappointed many people who wanted something else. But, you know, the central message of just trying to figure out what loving your enemy means takes a sort of a lifetime to figure out. And we've never really had systematic theologies. There are no great chapters in the creeds that go in detail what loving your enemy should look like. It seems to be a big gap in a lot of Christian thinking. And so just that revolutionary message really, I think, turns classical rhetoric in many ways. There's a lot of good in classical rhetoric, but it turns sort of the heart of it on its head.
I just preached on the parable of the Good Samaritan, and I thought that I already knew everything that could be known about it because, you know, I preached on it before, and, you know, what more can you say about the parable of the Good Samaritan? I was stunned looking at it again, just how radical that message was. Love is about your enemy. It's not just loving people near you, loving the people nature requires you to love, your wife and your children. It's actually tested by loving your enemy. Who's my neighbor? The Samaritan, if you're a Jew. The Jew, if you're a Samaritan. That really is a radical message, isn't it?
And really hard to overcome those deep-set American habits.
I love people who think like me. My neighbor is the person who's in my silo with me, imbibing the same social media and the same news feeds. Those are my neighbors. Those are the people I love. But that I'm called to love the people on the other side is really, that's when it gets
definitely
dicey. You apply this challenge in our day to the messages of memes that get spread around and go viral.
Yeah, memes, I'm fascinated. It's a fascinating sort of little bit of contemporary rhetoric to keep an eye on. Some are hilarious. And so, yeah, but even in that, you see this difference. I think most of them tend to be, at least in Christian circles, sort of expressions of this rhetoric of domination, how stupid some opponent is. They usually tend to be very self-righteous. I don't think the users tend to see, right? We set ourselves up as the judges over other Christians, over some foolishness and unbelief.
Lord, I thank you that I'm not like this publican.
Yeah. Exactly. But we don't see that. We don't see that self-righteousness. So memes are just sort of another expression of this same pattern between domination and love.
We'll say things, even as pastors, on Facebook that we would never say face-to-face.
Yeah, that is a strange.
Extraordinary.
Either that there's some sort of perceived anonymity there or some sort of cushion. Maybe it's like being in our car singing or something like that.
How much does this affect interaction with Christians of other traditions as well? You know, it's very easy for us to talk about truth, goodness, and beauty in a way that is ugly, in a way that really is self-righteous. You know, a theology of sufficient grace of God in Christ, and yet we can present that gracious message ungraciously.
Oh, definitely. All the time. Long sort of ugly history of that. I think the verse that sort of directed my thinking in this book was, you know, the goodness of God leads to repentance, right? And trying to think about what's involved in that. And when we think of what our theological traditions, you know, whatever tradition we're in, we see goodness in that. And how can we use the goodness in our tradition to sort of lead people to the Lord? And there are places for wrath and sarcasm. Those all have their places. I think it takes a certain maturity, right? Jesus can be good at it. I may not be so good at it. but I know that I'm in loving my neighbor and loving my enemy. I can try to use this goodness to win them over or describe my tradition.
That makes me think of the relationship between God's goodness and our goodness. Can you talk about that a little bit? We talk about, you know, the true, the good, and the beautiful. Ultimately, we believe that is God.
Yes.
How should that lead us then to truthful, good, and beautiful speech?
Yeah, right. At the center of the true, the good, and the beautiful in the triune God is of course, love itself. God is love. And so that tempers our view of beauty, our view of truth. That shapes, tempers is a little too weak a word almost. I mean, it's really everything about truth, beauty, and goodness comes out of the Trinitarian expression of love. And that was wanted to try to take that sort of Trinitarian expression and ask, then how should we speak? How should we do our rhetoric? How should we preach? That sort of thing. So it does have this shaping effect, and it is a little odd. I mean, at the center of the Greco-Roman view is power, right? It's not love. In polytheism, it's always a struggle between different gods and who can dominate whom. So power is really central to that rhetoric. But for us, it's supposed to be love, even though it's hard historically ever to live up to that. That's what's at the center of the triune God, and it should be at the center of our rhetoric.
So the goodness is a loving goodness. The truth is a loving truthfulness.
Yes.
And
okay.
The beauty is a loving beauty, the beauty of love.
Yes.
Talk us through a little bit more here about Jesus' specific warnings in this regard. Not only does he exhibit the power of weakness, but calls us to strive for reconciliation over against his real anger at people calling each other a fool. Sometimes that just sort of jumps out at it. He couldn't really have meant that.
You get commentators on all sides of that issue, of course, but I thought at least it'd be an interesting thought experiment. What if we set that constraint on ourselves of not calling anybody a fool? obviously, there are places where it's appropriate and it fits, but we're so deep into the world where it's easy to call people foolish that maybe we could just practice for a few decades not calling anybody a fool and sort of seeing the practical effects on that.
Give it a chance.
Yeah, give it a chance. How could I communicate with fellow believers about unbelievers if I don't call the unbelievers a fool? What else am I forced to do then? I think it'd be an interesting experiment.
Another point you bring out is, you touched on it briefly at the beginning, but this cultivation of the habit of careful listening. You point out from James 1:19, know this, my beloved brothers, let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger. That's a super important ethic for us to recover these days, isn't it?
And it's especially difficult, I think. Again, going back to social media. Social media is sort of this prophetic place where we can stand. And I think
quick to speak.
Quick to speak. And pastors feel like they have to be, they're obligated to speak about every issue that comes out. And that gets exhausting. It puts too much pressure on pastors.
And it divides the church, doesn't it?
Yeah,
because
it does.
Basically, if you're not in my silo, if you don't like my movies, my sports teams, my political party, my views, then I'm really not going to probably be a useful servant of the Lord to you.
Right, exactly. And I think part of the temptation is because we've got access to the internet, we think we can become easy experts in things, whether it's a school shooting or something out of D.C.
Everybody's an expert.
Everybody's an expert.
Yeah.
And I don't remember seeing that so much. It might have been, it was just slower maybe in the 70s and the 80s. But now, sort of that sort of thrill of being the expert. Mm-hmm. And I confessed, having done that in my past as well. And finally, I just thought, you know, I was wrong enough times. I thought, it's time to shut up. It's time to shut up and listen.
Let's not Google it. Let's talk to somebody who actually holds that view and see if they are persuasive. One of the things I tell my students all the time is that, you know, there's this thing called the ninth commandment. Not misrepresenting your opponent's view falls into that. And so if you're going to write a paper, the first thing you have to do is demonstrate that you actually have represented that position in a way that the person could not, and say, yeah, okay, he got me right. A lot of times you get in those early papers, because right out of the gate, this person's a heretic. But that careful process, by the time they're, you know, in their second or third year, you start to see this emerging where that really happens. And how important is it that first, in a rhetoric of love, we represent the position of others in terms they would actually recognize as their own before we critique?
Very important. First, let me say that your effectiveness as a teacher, I work now with some of your former students. And when I asked before coming here, I thought, you know, tell me a little about Michael Horton. And that's exactly what they went to. They were able to remind me that you said you've got to insist on being fair. So it has stuck. So congratulations to you. And these are great gentlemen I get to work with.
They are.
That live it. And I think the ability to fairly represent something, we get nervous for some reason as Christians. We feel like maybe we're betraying God because we know that God might be angry at a certain position. And so especially with younger students, it's a question of loyalty. Am I being disloyal? Shouldn't I start off immediately condemning something? And so what I try to argue in the book is God's patient too, and God's far more patient with some people than we are. He loved David, after all. But trying to get them to state the position even beyond fairness, but in a way that that person, him or herself, would do it. Extremely difficult.
And how to actually read sympathetically or empathetically.
Yeah.
So that you actually could understand why an intelligent person would hold that view. You still think it's wrong.
Yes. But, and that's the key, thinking that the other side is intelligent and they've got their own histories and their own struggles and they come to this because of all those things put together, and they might be smarter than we are, but it's so easy to simplify the other side.
A lot of young people growing up these days are exposed to so many things that we weren't exposed to, that really, if we don't have a habit of charity in our conversation about people with whom we disagree sharply, we're going to lose our children as well. Let's say they're struggling with gender identity, or they have friends who are gay, and they hear people at church or at home talking about these people as these people.
Oh, definitely. It's heartbreaking. And it's especially, I think you've hit it right on the head. There are Christians going into college now that have come from many conservative homes have heard that sort of the rhetoric of domination in their own home. And then they go and actually meet real people. They meet non-Christian professors who are not rabid relativists and blaspheming here and there, but are people trying to do a good job and trying to understand the world the best they can, and they're kind. Mm-hmm. And so it creates doubt in the faith that they had. And yeah, you see that repeatedly in exactly the way you've laid out.
You say love calls us to a higher view of emotion and a greater respect for our audience. What do you mean by that?
Yeah,
it's a suspicious thing to say.
Yeah, I think emotion's gotten a bad rap in much of Western history. And it started with the Greeks and Romans.
It's a good thing in Reform circles that's not an issue.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it took me a long time to persuade myself of this. But yeah, it started, I think, if we had to blame, you know, ancient Greek philosophers that made a sharp division between emotion and rationality. Emotionality, rationality. And then that gets revived again in the Enlightenment. You have all the Enlightenment philosophers really liking rationality and denigrating imagination and emotion. But that sharp dichotomy is big in the Western classical tradition. But I don't think it's big in Scripture. You don't find those sharp dichotomies because we're more wholes. We're this mix of reason and emotion and imagination. And it's much more blended together. So I wanted to push back in this book a bit about that, because Aristotle likes to separate, you know, logos and pathos and ethos. And I want to suggest they're a little bit closer. You don't just have emotional arguments. I mean, emotional appeals. There are appeals that emphasize those things, but there's always some logic involved. And in any logic, there's always some emotion. Even if you are a cold-hearted judge, well, cold-hearted is an emotion. Mm. So I like to see those things more blended together. And
so a biblical worldview where the heart is actually the seat,
yes,
of the person,
yeah,
which is not emotion over the intellect, but just the heart as sort of the seat of the whole person.
Definitely, definitely.
When we present our own arguments, you say we need to be open to questioning. But when it comes to religious conversations, often this is where people begin to get a little uncomfortable. When somebody starts asking you questions, your natural instinct might be a little defensive. Is that in part, Doug, because we're worried we don't have answers? I mean, do you get the sense that in a lot of cases, even in debates over doctrine, or let's say when a young person asks, well, how do we know that the Bible is the Word of God and not the Quran or the Bhagavad Gita, that when those questions are asked, parents or church leaders kind of get a little rattled sometimes, in part because they themselves don't know how to answer?
Oh, definitely. I think defensiveness comes from that. And part of it might be that pressure for everyone to be an expert. You know, maybe we could have some leeway not to have the answers, but not be—
I don't know is okay.
Yeah, I don't know is okay. And if a parent has I don't know, but has strong sort of a tradition with that child of loving and caring, then that child can accept the I don't know. But if everything sort of hangs on the ideas first rather than on character of a person, then it's much more difficult as a parent, as a teacher, to say, I don't know.
Remember my mom, when we were having debates over the doctrines of grace, she would say, you know, I don't know, but you know where to look it up. And let's read the scriptures together. And we did. And she ended up really becoming a great ambassador of the doctrines of grace. But it began there with me. That was a great example to me of someone saying, not just I don't know, period, but I don't know, let's look at it together. Let's study that together. That really is the way to do it, isn't it? To bring people along and say, even when we don't know, we're going to have to work on this. We're going to have to work through this because you raise a really important question. And doesn't that validate the importance of the question they're asking.
Yeah, oh, definitely. That idea of giving the responsibility to the student to figure things out is an act of love itself, right? Because they won't really own it if we just declare it to them. But if they have to work through it and then come to a conclusion, then they'll own it, whatever that conclusion is. But hopefully they'll remember that respect that we showed them and that freedom we gave. We try to guide as much as possible. I remember having a class exercise the other day where we had students playing different parts of 19th century artists, actually, and they were arguing between each other, realists and impressionists and so forth. And it was a fun exercise, and I had to consciously restrain myself, right? I'm supposed to be a fly on the wall in this conversation, because they were wrong about some things. They were misrepresenting the people they were supposed to be acting like and so forth. But I was glad I shut up, because the exercise really helped them work through these issues and better understand. And it took a week or so longer than I would have liked to have seen, but having them own it and work through it was much better as a pedagogical tool, at least.
Can we go back for a moment to the rhetoric of power versus the rhetoric of love? Can you highlight for us various moments at which this really came to a head, even with the disciples? You know, they loved Jesus and had a wonderful plan for his life in Jerusalem. They were going to be up there on the platform, inaugurated as, you know, his cabinet. How did Jesus shake up their view of the rhetoric of love versus power?
Yeah, I think, you know, the first place we see, of course, is in the incarnation itself, right? He doesn't come into the world the way a powerful person would. And so Christmas is an expression of the rhetoric of love. And then, of course, Easter as well. But the whole church calendar is an expression of that rhetoric of love. So everything is framed by that. And then within it, you get these episodes where the apostles want to call down fire on somebody, which has Old Testament precedent in a sense. But his response is, you don't know what spirit you're of, right? These things might be effective at some points in redemptive history, but it's as if Jesus wants to try something new.
It's interesting, too, that he says, I came to preach the gospel,
yeah,
not to do what you're doing.
Yes, yeah.
Big contrast between the two rhetorics right there, right? They want to incinerate these people who aren't embracing the gospel, and Jesus is saying, no, let's go to another town where we can preach the gospel. That's why I've come, to persuade people to embrace this message.
Definitely. And all along, episodes like healing a centurion's servant, right? The idea that here is the oppressor of our people. Here is an enemy of the people of Palestine at that time, a Roman occupier, a centurion of all, who've probably, you know, hurt family members of those around there, and that he's willing to heal and compliment even this centurion. And then, of course, dealing with tax collectors, prostitutes, and so forth, dealing with people that don't stand high rhetorically in that society. Jesus keeps turning things over and over.
People you shouldn't have dinner with.
Yes, yes, definitely.
Invite people who can't pay you back.
Yes, yes.
Don't invite your friends and family to supper. Invite people who can't pay you back. And that's exactly what he did. What about the foot washing episode? How does that display the rhetoric of love?
Yeah, definitely. So this ceremony, again, their expectations of a different way that Messiah would operate in the world, and he is sort of stopping them in their expectations and showing them that the rhetoric of love is really this goodness, right? That somebody who is a teacher, who is a leader, can serve in this very menial way. And I learned how important foot washing was in the Middle East. There was sand everywhere. It was just constantly on you, and you'd have different. I would have different shoes that I would wear inside and outside, just because you're constantly tracking sand in. And how nice it would be to have somebody to wash my feet, and so for him to take that role was, you know, one of the lowest of roles, and he wants them to imitate that servant attitude, that goodness leading to repentance, goodness leading to loving God. In the end, it all comes back to how do we try to help ourselves and others to love God.
I love the fact that John tells us, because he had all authority in heaven and on earth, he tells the story of him taking off his cloak, wrapping a towel around his waist, to wash his disciples' feet. You don't expect that to follow
right.
the words, because he had all power. Because he had all power, he took the form of a slave. That's astonishing.
Back to the confidence that we were talking about, or the fear of representing other positions. If you know that Jesus is the Son of God and Father, Son, and Spirit reign, then you don't have to worry about representing another position fairly, right? I'm a Christian. I'm devoted to Christ. But I can, because I'm confident in Christ, not in myself, then I can try to represent Muslims fairly because I'm not threatened.
You're not fearful.
Yeah, not fearful.
Yeah. Ultimately, of course, the cross itself. How does Jesus laying down his life, which is what he was telling them there in that action parable in the upper room, how does laying down his life, even for his enemies, reflect the humility that we are to imitate?
Yeah, that is the act, right? The major act. And, you know, in the midst of that, I mean, having his people see that and knowing that this is the demeanor of his kingdom, the demeanor of his kingship, and the shock of the line on the cross, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." That's got such depth. I don't think we're just barely scratching the surface on that one. So much is connected in there. But to have our king say that in those circumstances is very, very striking. And that sort of shapes everything else. If he can do that in that situation, right, certainly I can represent somebody fairly. Certainly I can listen a little bit more. Certainly I don't have to always be satirical and embarrassing my opponents. He wasn't doing that at that moment.
But resurrection, how do we get the rhetoric of love out of the resurrection?
Yeah. Well, I think at the heart of the rhetoric of love is, at the heart of love as well, is this creativity, right? That part of our rhetoric is to be creative and to try to say things differently in a way that attracts attention, in a way that wins our audience over. And certainly the resurrection is an act of new creation, right? We've got new life here. The Spirit is doing new things. God is doing new things. We expected death, and he's even able to overcome death. Another one of those surprises along the way. Everybody thought the story was done, and yet it comes back with new life. And so that's crucial to try to find ways to imitate resurrection life in our rhetoric.
Moving on to Paul then, there really is a standard for us there. If you're going to talk about the rhetoric of love versus the rhetoric of power, in Paul's terms, the wisdom of the cross versus the wisdom of the world. Why does Paul think, if he gets out of the way and pushes his rhetorical skill to the background, the persuasiveness of the cross itself will draw us to Christ?
Yes, huge topic, as you say, in Paul, and carrying on the model laid out by Christ. It is fascinating to watch how Paul at times struggles with different rhetorics, but certainly love is central to his ministry. And a lot of this book is set up looking at 1 Corinthians 13. What are these things of love, and how would that shape us? I love the, you know, when Paul exhorts, I mean, this is part of the rhetoric of love, that God's strength is made perfect in weakness, right? And again, you could put weakness in quotes, in a sense. It looks like weakness to the Greeks and the Romans to preach the way of the cross, to live the way of love. Of course, it's the most powerful thing, and that's the ironic and surprising.
Like the cross itself, it looked like Jesus lost.
Yes, the end of things, and it was the beginning of this new world, a new community. It's wonderful to watch Paul work through these issues.
You know, a lot of times people will say that the Apostle Paul was, they'll interpret his language there about being a humble speaker, not very good at rhetoric and so forth, as an inherent weakness of Paul. I rather interpret it as Paul saying, in contrast to the super apostles who thought that the rhetoric would persuade and not the logic, but the degree of their flowery rhetoric would do the job. Paul says, I'm actually tapering back my rhetorical skills. Mm-hmm. I'm pushing myself out of the way so that Christ can be viewed.
I like that that take on it very much, especially that the last way you described it, pushing myself out of the way. I do think self-denial is a big part of the rhetoric of love, not complimenting ourselves through our rhetoric, backhanded compliments, but trying to figure out what does self-denial mean when I'm trying to persuade others. It's an odd tension. I want to win an argument, and yet I have to deny myself in that. So I would certainly see that line of self-denial in Paul. And I think you're right that he is contrasting perhaps with sort of the classical form of his day, which would draw attention to oneself, the flowery language, that sort of thing, putting yourself first. I also love in Paul his excitement and his passion, right? In this way, he sort of reminds me of David, to go back to King David again, who had this exuberant love for God. And Paul, in the midst of all these controversies, knows that he's part of this amazing story, this redemptive history, and his excitement is more than Greco-Roman rhetoric would allow, right? A little too intemperate, perhaps. But I love seeing that in Paul.
As pastors and hearers of sermons, how do we walk that fine line between denigrating rhetoric, saying that it's unimportant, quoting those verses in Paul to justify using speech that isn't true, good, and beautiful, not really thinking about our prayers, not thinking about the way we speak, and yet, on the other hand, so emphasizing the beauty of rhetoric, whether it's high church or low church, turning to aesthetics that get in the way of what it is and ultimately who it is we're trying to draw people to. How do you walk that fine line between a kind of anti-rhetoric approach and something that I think probably we struggle with more in circles that really like classical Christian education, diving into a rhetoric of power because that's what the Greeks and Romans did?
Yeah, it is a fine line. And I guess it'll take pastors some practice to try to figure out where that line is and being willing to fail and being honest with a congregation so that they give some space to experiment in a good way, in a godly way, within certain bounds, of course. But ultimately, what you're looking for is what – it's a servant's attitude. So as long as it's not an attitude of trying to aggrandize power and so forth, but if you're using different methods of rhetoric to try to help people, then you've got all sorts of tools available. But the motive, again, is service.
And bringing them to Christ, not to you.
Yes. Yeah, you know. Definitely.
Oh, wow. Folks, the book is titled The Rhetoric of Love, and the author is Doug Jones. Doug, thanks so much for being with us and sharing your wisdom on this really important subject.
Oh, thank you so much for the opportunity. It's great to see you face to face.
You too as well.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about this program, visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. If you sign up as an innkeeper, architect, or reformer, not only will you get a complimentary subscription to our magazine, Modern Reformation, but you'll also get longer editions of every White Horse Inn broadcast. To find out how to join one of these support programs, click on the support tab of our website, whitehorseinn.org. You can also give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. We'll see you next time at the White Horse Inn.